Friends, did you know that the temperature at night can have one of the biggest impacts on your sleep quality? If you often wake up too hot or too cold, I can definitely recommend Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. In addition to their self-cooling properties for better quality sleep, Miracle Made bedding has awesome self-cleaning properties so you can say goodbye to stale odors. And you'll get the luxurious, super comfortable feel we're all looking for without the ridiculously high price tag. I have to be honest with you guys, I truly love my white Miracle Made sheets. They are so clean, they are so crisp, and they prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. This leaves them to stay cleaner and fresher 3 times as long than other sheets. Most other sheets, they're teeming with little allergy and acne-causing bacteria that you do not want in your bed. So, why don't you just listen to me and go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code thestacks at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it is backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you are not 100% satisfied, you get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks and use the code thestacks to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode and making my bedtime even better. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today we are joined by the New York Times bestselling author, Keith O'Brien, whose previous books include Paradise Falls, Fly Girls, and Outside Shot. His new book is called Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. It is an incredible look at the history of baseball, America, and one of the game's most iconic figures, Pete Rose. Keith and I talked today about why he wanted to write this book, about the ins and outs of the history of baseball, Pete Rose as the Great White Hope, and so much more. Don't forget to listen next week, Wednesday, April 24th, to our book club episode, where I'll be joined by Hala Alyan, who will discuss the poetry collection, The January Children by Safia El-Hilo. Quick reminder, everything we talk about on today's episode of The Stacks can be found in the link in the show notes. Oh, heads up. There are now 2 ways to support The Stacks. One is The Stacks Pack, of course, which you can find over on Patreon. And the other is my brand new Substack called Unstacked. Both places allow you to get inside access to me and The Stacks for $5 a month. And both of those places make this show possible every single week. And yes, you can join both the Patreon and the Substack. If you're looking for a community of readers to discuss books, through our virtual book club or on our Discord, go through with the Patreon at patreon.com/thestacks. If you want more of my thoughts and hot takes on books and pop culture, you're going to find yourself over on Unstacked, which is tracythomas.substack.com. Both places do get the monthly bonus episode of The Stacks Unabridged. And again, both places make it possible for me to make the show. So head to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack or go to tracythomas.substack.com to read Unstacked. A fun perk of the Stacks Pack, though, is getting a shout out on this show. So here's a special thank you to Alyssa, Lindy Hewitt, Ellen Cusimano, Margene Smith, War Height, Rebecca Patine, Thels Will, and Minnie. And of course, thank you to everyone over on Unstacked and the Stacks Pack for making this show possible. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Keith O'Brien. All right, everybody. I am so excited for today's episode. You all know how much I love sports. You all know how much I love baseball. And last week, I picked up this new book called Charlie Hustle, and it's about Pete Rose. And I thought, I'm just going to read this and see. I fell so in love with this book that I immediately reached out to the head of the publisher, Lisa Lucas, friend of the show, and was like, give me Keith O'Brien's publicist. We have to make this happen. So I am thrilled to welcome the author of Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball, Keith O'Brien, welcome to the Stacks.
Oh my gosh, it's my pleasure. I love your podcast. I love your passion for books, and I'm so excited to be here.
If you think I have a passion for books, wait till we start talking about the Hall of Fame, because I have a real passion for a sports debate. That's really my true heart and soul.
Well, I'm here for that.
So, I mean, I sort of told people what the book's about, but in about 30 seconds or so, will you just tell people in your own words what Charlie Hustle is all about?
The book is about one of our undeniable icons, whether you love him or hate him, Pete Rose. But more broadly, to me, it's about an ordinary man from an ordinary working class neighborhood, a man of ordinary talents and athleticism who, frankly, probably never should have made the major leagues, much less become baseball's all-time hit leader, who does all those things, climbs to the mountaintop, scrapes and claws his way there with a lot of lucky breaks along the way. And then through his own personal decisions, through his own personal choices, through his own addictions, he loses it all.
Yeah. You can't say this, but I can. Pete Rose is sort of a monster. I have to tell you, okay, both of my godfathers are former baseball players. One is a former manager. I grew up like in a very baseball-centric, sports-centric household, and I'd always heard of Pete Rose. I was born in 1986, so when the whole scandal came out, I was too young to like understand anything. And so in my mind, he was like sort of a likable guy who just got wrapped up in trouble. So I'm like, let me pick up this book and see what the betting thing was all about. And as I'm reading the book, I just keep going to my husband, did you know Pete Rose was the worst person maybe ever to play baseball, but also so good at baseball? And I don't know if that's because like time has changed his reputation and all we know now, or like all we think about now is like he cheated and he got kicked out. But like to me, I was shocked by how scandalous he was.
He was like a rolling scandal in the 1970s and 80s. And I think what's compelling about it to me are a few things. You know, one, you know, by the mid-1970s, so 14 years before his personal disaster becomes an American disaster, it's well known, an open secret, frankly, in the Cincinnati Reds clubhouse about what he's doing off the field. And, you know, I don't mean betting on baseball, but betting with bookies, gambling a lot, sleeping around. You know, all of these things were open secrets by the late 1970s. I think the other thing that's really compelling about Pete Rose is, especially now, I feel like people love to look at him in black and white. You know, we either paint him in white like a hero who should have been led into the Hall of Fame many, many years ago, or we paint him in black, you know, like a monster. And he's earned all of those portraits, whatever paint color you use. But to me, what I liked about the narrative was being able to paint in gray too.
And
I say that without, you know, I'm not here to defend Pete Rose. The book doesn't defend Pete Rose, but he's a flawed man, incredibly flawed. And most compelling to me is some of the same reasons why he ever succeeded as a player, some of the same qualities why he succeeded as a player are the same qualities that doomed him to failure as a person.
Yeah, and I think like you're so right that people sort of paint him black and white, and I you know, I call him a monster jokingly, but I think what I loved about the book is that he really is, he's like a great anti-hero. He's giving Tony Soprano, he's giving Walter White. Like he's a guy I was rooting for him, even though I was like, I truly despise you because you're not only was he having extramarital affairs, but like some of them with underage women. He was having like children with some of his girlfriends. He was doing all of the things that we hate and are supposed to hate, but because he was like this larger than life character. And like, I mean, and also his baseball play, he was sliding, you know, he's the reason we have all these rules about sliding now. Like he was like a bad dude, but I think I speak for myself and a lot of people. We like to root for bad dudes. I always joke that my favorite athletes are the chesty ones, you know? Like, I love Draymond Green. I want my athlete to be someone that I don't want to be friends with, but that I know is going to do everything they can to win at every moment. Like, when Bryce Harper was, like, walking to first base and he got chewed out, I was like, yeah, Bryce Harper, don't be that fucking guy. Run to first base. And so, like, Pete Rose embodies so much of that, of like, I'm going to win at all costs, which is horrible for a person, but fantastic for an athlete.
And fantastic for narrative, too. You know, fantastic yes. for story.
Fantastic for a person writing a biography on, say, Pete Rose.
Yes, yes. I mean, take Draymond Green for a second. And I love that we worked Draymond Green into this conversation. That's fantastic.
Yes. We're going to get to Ohtani, too, people. Don't you worry.
In the 70s and 80s in the NBA, there were lots of Draymond Greens.
Everyone was Draymond.
Yes. And they were in your face and they got in fights on the floor and then they got kicked out of the game. And it didn't turn into a 5-day saga on ESPN debating and right. his worth to our culture and hand-wringing about his behavior on the floor. Guys did what they needed to do to win, and the sports writers moved on. And in the social media world, in the 24-hour cable sports world, we need to have a hot take on these guys every single morning, every single hour. And so it turns Draymond Green, to use your example, into this incredible villain. And the fact is, there were lots of guys who did those things on the baseball diamond, on the football field, on the basketball court in the 70s and 80s. And they did and said things off the field too, sometimes to reporters on the record that ended up in quotes in the newspaper that you could simply never get away with today. And Pete Rose lives in this world, and he's got like the ultimate hall pass because the sports writers love him. They love him. Yeah. And I think there are two reasons why they love him that are really important. The one is just a tangible reason. They love him because he's accessible.
Because he talked to them.
He will talk to them. And when they come by his locker after a game, he doesn't shut them down. He doesn't give them two quotes. He'll sit there and he'll talk to them for 45 minutes. And longtime sports writers, talking about guys who did the job for 20, 30 years, said that, you know, if they ever needed a column idea or they were ever out of story ideas, they'd just go to Pete Rose's locker and they'd walk away with three ideas. That's one. That's a real reason why, you know, media will like a source, any source. But the other reason is more subtle. For the first 16 years of Pete Rose's baseball career, there are no women in major league locker rooms. None. They're not allowed. Mm. And when women finally win entrance to major league locker rooms in 1979, it's with federal court orders and lawsuits.
Right.
So
right.
It's the ultimate old boys club. And let's be honest, it's an old white boys club. You know, there were very few prominent writers of color at the big newspapers. So the white baseball press loves Pete Rose, this white working class guy. He reflects upon them a story that we like, that frankly America likes. You know, this story that if you work hard and you try hard and you hustle, you can do anything. We love that American story. Pete Rose is that story. And so he gets a hall pass and they're going to look past all of these off-field foibles.
Yeah. I want to talk about the race element in this story because my godfather is Dusty Baker, former Reds manager, and he knew Pete back in the day. And when I was reading this book, I had to Google and be like, what did Baker say about this? Because I remember he had something to say. And one of the things that he said on the record, like I think the Cincinnati newspaper, was that he thought Pete should be let into the Hall of Fame. And one of the reasons why is because when he was a young player, he and Ralph Garr, you know, they'd go to these different cities and the older black players would invite them over for dinner with their families. And the only white player who ever did that was Pete Rose. And so Dusty always had sort of a soft spot or has a soft spot for him because of that. Because in the time when race was so prominent in baseball in a way that it is different now, because now it's more like ethnicity, right? It's about like American born players versus like foreign born players. But in the 70s, it was really like about race. He was not a racist, which is sort of shocking because he was a lot of other horrible things, you know, like based on the book. And what's really interesting about that to me, and I guess where the question is that he was presented as this great white hope. He was the person that white people could latch onto as our greatest. And he was the guy, you know, when there were so many black players that were really beloved. And then there was also Roberto Clemente for a period of time, right? There's all these black and brown players that people really got behind. Pete Rose was the white guy, but he wasn't really playing into that in his own personal life. So I'm wondering if any of that came up for you and like sort of what you make of all of that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I love that anecdote from Dusty. I wish I had interviewed you to get to Dusty for that anecdote.
I did text him after I read the book. I'll tell you what he said off the record because it was private, but he still is fond of Pete.
Fascinating.
That's what I'll say.
So this is a very interesting dichotomy within Pete Rose. You know, he's from this white working class part of Cincinnati called the West Side, a specific neighborhood in there on the West Side called Anderson Ferry. You know, his entire high school was almost entirely white. So he comes up in this culture. Baseball itself is very white in the 1960s. We forget that, but it was.
Right.
And one of the first lessons Pete gets as a rookie is that his teammates, the white players, the famous ones on the team, don't like him because he had jumped the line. He had jumped in front of more established players. He had maybe been called up too soon because he was a great Cincinnati story. And he had taken the job of a popular white second baseman named Don Blasingame. And it doesn't help that Pete is incredibly arrogant and brash, and even as a rookie is saying all the wrong things, you know, publicly saying how great he is. So they don't like him. And in the early weeks of his first year in professional baseball, there are really only two friends that he has on his team. And one is future Hall of Famer Frank Robinson, and the other is Vada Pinson, the black players. And Frank Robinson, you know, died before I could interview him for this book. But Robbie said later that, you know, they understood what Pete was going through because they knew what it felt like to be an outcast too. Mm. And so they invite him out to dinner and breakfast on the road. You know, Frank Robinson buys his meals, a thing that an established player might do for a kid rookie. And it's funny because Pete Rose, both then, throughout his career, and now, cannot speak about race or anything in the progressive vocabulary of the day. And you know, even into the 1970s, you know, at roasts and such things for some of his players, you know, would some of his teammates would make jokes in which the punchline is a racial trope. Mm. But in interview after interview that I did with black teammates that he had over the years, they all said that they loved him. And one of the most powerful interviews I did was with a player named George Foster, who Dusty would certainly know, and many of your listeners will know. George Foster was an epic home run hitter in the 1970s, pre-steroids, obviously. Mm-hmm. And you know, by the end of the decade, is one of the best power hitters in baseball. But in his earliest days with the Reds, George Foster is a bench warmer. He's nobody. And they don't know what they have in him. And there was a scene that I found in my research in a newspaper article in the early 1970s after a game when Pete Rose demands to go hit in that moment, to go practice in that moment as the sun is setting at Riverfront Stadium. And they let him because it's Pete Rose and you can't stop that man from hitting a baseball. And George Foster goes out that night and shags balls in the outfield for him. And Pete hits for like an hour until the coach's arm is about to fall off. And then because George has been shagging balls all night, Pete Rose asks, you know, George, do you want to hit? I'll throw you BP. And, you know, for the next hour, it's Pete Rose throwing BP to George Foster, who is no one.
Right.
And when I found Foster and he agreed to speak to me. We talked about lots of things, of course, but I wanted to talk about this scene. Does he remember this scene? And I thought, there's just no way George Foster would remember this. George Foster has played a million baseball games and, you know, done batting practice a gajillion times. There's no way. And when I asked Foster, he absolutely remembered it. And what he told me was he remembered it because no white player, and specifically he said no white star, had ever treated him like that before, had ever treated him that well before.
So interesting. And Joe Morgan also was a fan of his till the end, till the end of Joe Morgan's life, that is. But what about the part of it where he is like this great white hope? How did he engage with that aspect? I'm sure he loved it. He seems like a kind of guy who'd love being anybody's great hope in anything. But it sort of seems like at odds with this like guy who's maybe good on race, at least maybe not good on race like publicly, but at least like good to his black teammates, which is, you know, in the, especially in that day and age, good on race because he did not have to be.
Yeah, I think one thing we've forgotten is that, you know, when Pete Rose is in baseball, especially that first 15 years in baseball, it's changing so much.
Yeah.
And the world is changing so much in the way it's changing right now. And there is, just as there is a segment of the population right now who is recoiling from so many cultural changes that are happening that are more inclusive to others, there was a segment of the population in the 1960s and 70s that was recoiling from that.
Yeah.
And you know, baseball is part of that. You know, it becomes incredibly more diverse in the first decade that Pete is in the league. You know, it goes from, you know, all-star teams being almost entirely white to, by the early 1970s, all-star starters being, you know, predominantly black or Latino. So in this world, Pete Rose is now this symbol of a bygone time. And and yet he's not being paid, Pete Rose isn't, by, you know, the standards of a Roberto Clemente or a Willie Mays. And there are reasons for that. Willie Mays and Roberto were far more established, you know, by 1970 than Pete was. But he wants that money. He wants that kind of recognition. And so, yeah, he does, you know, at least on a couple of occasions, you know, use his race and his status as the, quote, great white hope to foster the greater sense that he should be paid more. And, you know, one of these happens around 1969 and he, you know, tells the press that he's the best white player in the game. And in saying that, what he's saying is I want to be paid like the best players, like Willie Mays. And Pete denies the comment when it makes the papers, you know, for all the reasons we could understand.
Yeah.
But the beat writers who knew him best at the time, you know, wrote columns saying, well, he denied it, but that sure sounds like Pete Rose to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Feels sort of on brand for him. I mean, I think that was what was so shocking when I read what Dusty said. I was like, really? Because he doesn't seem like that guy. But it does. It also does make sense. I mean, I think that's what's so great about his story and the book and just like learning about him is that he is a lot of things that feel really obvious. And then he's also a lot of things where you're like, oh, I'm sort of surprised by this about you, or like, I'm sort of surprised that this happened this way, or this is where you came from, or this is where you were headed. I normally like start interviews with this question, but we just were rolling, but I do want to know where, I know you're from Cincinnati. So I know that, you know, he must be loom large in your, you know, sports world, but when did you get the idea for this book? Why did you want to write this story? Like, did you grow up a huge Reds fan? Were you always curious, or did something happen more recently that made you say, I'm going to write this book now?
Like all the writers, fiction or nonfiction, you talk to, I got that long list of ideas, half-baked, some of them, you know, about books I might want to write. And Pete Rose has just been on that list for some time. In part because I feel like while we know the general outlines of his story, that rise and fall, I do feel like most people, even baseball fans, have forgotten why we ever cared about P. Rose in the first place. We've forgotten why he does loom so large over baseball and over our sports culture. And so I did believe that if I could get access to Rose and folks in his inner circle and tell a human story, that it could be really compelling. And one reason I believed that is that this story is so powerful on its own. And one of the challenges I faced, especially after I did all my reporting and had all my federal court documents and had thousands of pages of baseball investigative records, was just staying out of the way. You know, sometimes when you're writing, you have to figure out what is the structure here? You know, how do I fit this part in? But Pete's is sort of that epic, tragic structure, that epic, you know, Greek tragedy. And I did really begin to think of it in that way. You know, he was, you know, as I wrote in the author's note, I began to see him as Icarus in red stirrup socks and cleats. He's going to fly. Pete Rose is going to fly, but he is going to fall. And I thought if I had the access, that that would be powerful. And I just knew that knowing Cincinnati, knowing the part of town where he grew up, knowing guys like Pete Rose my whole life would provide insight to my reporting. You know, there's that old cliche, right? Write what you know. I've moved away from Cincinnati a long time ago, but I know this story. And I know what it felt like at the high and the low. You know, like you, I wasn't alive for the whole arc. I don't remember the 1970s at all. But I remember exactly where I was on the night when Pete Rose set the all-time hit record in 1985. I know what that felt like. And I also remember living through the scandal in 1989 as a baseball fan, as a Cincinnatian, and traveling that whole road with him from, you know, defending him to decrying him to ultimately feeling saddled by this story. And again, I think baseball is still saddled with the Pete Rose story.
Yeah. Okay. I want to take a break and then I'm going to relate to you about this story. So we'll be right back. When I started podcasting, an online store was truly the furthest thing from my mind. Now I'm selling super cute sweatshirts, tote bags, other bookish swag, and it's so easy. All because I use Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit $1 million order stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, they have you covered. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system for wherever or whatever you're selling. If you came to the Stax tour and bought merch, that was the in-person POS system. I'm just telling you, I use it. I love it. Turn your casual browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. It is 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. In case you don't know, I was an emotional mess when I first saw the Stax merchandise on a listener while out in public. After starting this podcast and building a community, I had to be talked into creating merchandise, and Shopify made it possible. There is a 0% chance I would have merch if Shopify wasn't so easy to use. Did you know Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/thestax, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/thestax now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/thestax. Okay, y'all, this past week, I threw a party in LA to celebrate the LA Times Book Festival and just generally bookish people all around. And it was the best time. I'm sure you've seen the pictures on Instagram, but I have to say a huge thank you to Lit Cocktails for helping make this party a total blast. Lit Cocktails is a mobile bartending company that provides a fun, personable, unique, yet professional experience for clients who want more than your average boring black tie bartenders. They're here for weddings, birthday parties, corporate events, or any other reason you might need to celebrate with a cocktail. Lit Cocktails is owned and operated by Diamond Davis, a Black LGBTQ woman who started the company after losing her job as a restaurant manager during the 2020 pandemic. Diamond has created more than just a service. It is truly an experience, and it celebrates diversity, love, and community. I could feel that from the bar the entire evening. Diamond was a joy to have. She made the best drinks, always had a smile on her face, and honestly became one of my new favorite people. Lit Cocktail packages include ice, garnishes, cups, napkins, straws, a customized menu, two specialty cocktails, non-alcoholic beverages and mixers, one free hour of setup and breakdown, and an alcohol shopping list. Literally, you don't need to do anything but hire Diamond. She takes care of the rest. They also offer tastings for an additional fee, where they customize 8 to 10 drinks based on your flavor profile, and they'll even bring them to your home for you to sample. Go book a free consultation today by visiting www.litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram. Again, that's litcocktailsllc.com or send a DM to @litcocktails on Instagram.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Bite.
Okay, we're back. I'm going to share my personal similarities because it does come up at the end of the book and I do want to talk about it, which is I am a San Francisco Giants fan. And I was at the game where Barry Bonds hit 71 and 2, I believe. I obviously was a Giant. My dad was from San Francisco. Baker was the manager when I was a kid. I was a Giants fan. I am a Giants fan. I met my husband at a San Francisco Giants bar in New York City in 2010. I am a Giants fan through and through. But of course, Barry Bonds complicates that narrative in a way that I think is really similar to what happens with Pete Rose, right? Does this person belong in the Hall of Fame? Do his records count? And obviously, steroids is slightly different because it's more tied to the records that were broken, right? Pete Rose was betting on baseball as a manager, which affects the outcomes of the games, but doesn't affect his ability to hit the hits that he hit to make the hit record. But that feeling of feeling saddled with this person, I totally relate to. And when we get to the end of the book, I of course did not remember the timeline in the same way because I was very young, but we sort of get to Pete Rose, the whole thing. He goes to prison. He watches, you know, Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire play as the A's at the start of the steroid era. And it's sort of like, it goes right from Pete Rose scandal into what we now know as the steroid era. And then we come out of that and we get shit baseball. And now Major League Baseball has changed every rule to try to get us back to steroids era, Pete Rose era baseball, which I hate all of the rule changes so deeply. And I have to tell you, Keith, I get made so much fun of by every person I know who's like my age because they're like, "Are you a 75-year-old man that you care so deeply about these stupid?" Why is the bag bigger? They don't need a pitch clock. It's not a time. Like, I have real like retrograde opinions about the rule changes. But
I love it.
Anyways, all of that to say, what do you think about punishment in Major League Baseball? And I guess you can include the Astros sort of in this conversation too. Where are we on this? What should be going on? Like, I feel really torn because I feel that Pete Rose and Barry Bonds and all the steroids guys should all be in the Hall of Fame. They were the best of their time. If everyone's doing it, they were still the best. Put an asterisk, be done. But I'm curious what you think about all that.
Yeah, so to be clear, the book is not about making an argument for Pete Rose. It's not about making an argument against him.
Yes, you don't make an argument. And I want you to make one here.
I'm going to, yes. I have thought so much about it. And not just as someone who just wrote this book.
Yeah, right.
All the things you said about what baseball means to you and your personal connections with a baseball moment, I have all that. I feel that in my soul, like any baseball fan does. And so I too have wrestled with these questions. And I, in the course of the last 35 years with Pete Rose and the last 20 years with the steroid guys, I have probably touched all the bases from they should be out forever, they made their beds, that's it, it's over, and to other thoughts. And at this point, I have, I think, come full circle to a prevailing thought, which is I think we have completely lost perspective. You know, we like to put our athletes on pedestals and we like to ascribe to them moral values. And the fact is, for many of them, they're just really, really good at playing a little kid's game. And we don't know that much about them personally. We just don't. And the Shohei situation, the Shohei Ohtani story in the recent weeks, you know, shows that all over again. We don't know what we don't know with that story right now. But what we do know definitively is that a few weeks ago, no one would have ever predicted that a gambling controversy would be swirling around the golden god of baseball, Shohei Ohtani. So we don't know what we don't know. And for all those reasons, I believe that we should enshrine or not enshrine players in all sports based on what they did on the field, on the court, between the lines. It's the only thing we know for sure. And then if their crimes against the game or you know their mistakes off the field are so egregious, then we should put those on the plaque at Cooperstown, in my opinion, right next to the accomplishments. And you know, if we start going down the rabbit hole of the steroid guys versus Rose, we're going to need three or four podcasts to hash it out. But, you know, in my opinion, again, not part of the book, but in my opinion, the steroid era hurt baseball for me and for most fans more than the Rose problem did.
Certainly.
And I did struggle, and I have struggled with the steroid guys, Clemens and Bonds and A-Rod and all those guys. But at this point, I just feel like it's almost absurd to have a Hall of Fame in Cooperstown that just now objectively doesn't include some of the best players of the last four or five decades. It just doesn't make sense to me.
I'm with you. I have personal feelings about baseball writers because of this, because I'm convinced they just like don't like Barry Bonds because he's not a nice guy. He's very cold. And they took it personally, which I get. He lied to you. They all lied to you. But also, like, do your job and just vote these people in and leave me alone. Like, stay out of it.
Well, and Barry also has something in common with Pete Rose. You know, if you know everybody wanted Pete Rose from the earliest days of his scandal in 1989, everybody wanted Pete Rose to go on Oprah, to cry, to bare his soul to the world, admit his addictions and his problems, explain why. Why would you do this? And if he had done that, maybe the whole narrative is different. And I think the same can be said for Barry Bonds.
I think that's exactly
and right. The other steroid guys. You know, if they were to bare their souls on the stacks with you.
And what a dream.
Barry Bonds, right?
Your invitation is open.
Yes.
A-Rod, come on down.
Come on, let's go. If they were to do that, then it's different. And that was part of my pitch with Pete Rose when I did get access to him. You know, I explained that, you know, this is a time for reckoning, man. I mean, you're in your 80s now. Yeah. The people who were in the room, in the dugout, on the field, they're also in their 80s now. Since I started the research and reporting for my book, three different people have passed away, people that I interviewed. And so it's a time for reckoning. And I told Pete that we have to talk about the dark things too. Because if you let people into your darkness, and I don't mean that in a nefarious way, we all have our darkness, our regrets, our mistakes, the things we carry on our shoulders, those moments. God, we all have that. And if Pete Rose or Barry Bonds or anyone were to let people into the darkness, crack open the door to that room and let us understand why, then it is different. It is.
Yeah. I want to ask you about Pete Rose, because in the author's note, you mentioned that he was a part of the book. I think you phrased it as like he was a part of the process until he wasn't, or something like that. So what happened? What was that like? Obviously, he signed off on it at some point because you did have access to him, and sort of what changed? At what point did he decide he no longer wanted to talk to you?
Yeah. For starters, I want to say I'm really grateful that Pete Rose spoke to me. Yeah. 27 hours of recorded interviews on the phone and in person. Wow. It's significant for lots of reasons, but also because he'd never spoken to an author before unless he had editorial control over the book. He did not have that here. And he did talk to me about things, mistakes, moments, choices that he's never talked about before. And that is incredibly helpful to the story. And so I was glad to have it. But I did push him. Mm-hmm. And I know he felt that at times. And I think maybe in the end I pushed him as far as he was willing to go. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a falling out. There was no contentious moment. The last two times I saw him in person, the day ended with him saying, call me. Yeah, we'll get together again soon. Come back to Las Vegas where I live. Stay at that hotel again. That worked for me. We're good. But he did not reply to any of my texts or phone messages after that. So, you know, I lost him. And that happens sometimes in reporting. But I never had intended for this book to just be based upon Pete Rose's memories. When I started the project, I wasn't even sure I would get access to him. You know, I continued to do interviews with others in his inner circle, others who were on the field with him. And there is notably, you know, a trove of federal court records in Ohio that were so useful to me because, again, just like what's happening in Los Angeles right now surrounding Shohei Ohtani and his former interpreter, it was a federal investigation that first created problems in Pete's life. And it wasn't initially focused on Pete Rose. It was focused on men in his inner circle who were his good pals, who were, you know, hiding his secrets and placing his bets with bookies. These guys were into all kinds of activities. They pop up under the radar. And one thing that begins to happen in around 1987 is, you know, the walls begin to close around each of them. And one thing that I tried to do in the sort of final act of the book is convey that feeling that the walls are closing. One by one, these men around Pete get a knock on the door from an FBI agent or two or three, and they want to talk. And, you know, one by one, they all begin to talk and they all begin to turn on each other. And soon they're turning on Pete Rose too.
Yeah. Was there anything that you didn't get to ask Pete that you wish that you had?
So much. I mean, a voluminous amount of things, partially because, you know, I was doing those interviews and then I'm doing other interviews. And if you do an interview with someone else and they describe a scene or a moment or a choice or something that happened in a back room over a debate about $30,000 in gambling debts, I wasn't able to go back to Pete Rose and ask him about that. So, you know, that's certainly a problem. And so, you know, at times I had to work around that. you know, by doing other reporting, you know, by going to the court records or by trying to corroborate the story through other sources. And in a handful of instances in the book, I had to source it directly to, you know, one or two sources because I wasn't able to ask Pete Rose about it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Can you just speculate for me what you think's going on with Otani? Are you allowed to do that?
We're all speculating, right?
I know, but I'm like, I'm not sure if that's like a pro. I don't know if you're allowed to. I don't know. I mean, you're not like you're writing that book or anything. I have my own thoughts, but I also hate the Dodgers. So my thoughts are. Well, and I was also this, I started your book and the next day or 2 days later, the news. So of course, Pete Rose is front top of mind for me as I'm watching all of this. So I'm convinced he's the gambler. The interpreter is Tommy Giacomo or whatever the guy's name is Tommy.
Tommy Chiosa.
Chiosa, that's right. Tommy Giacomo is the former maitre d' at the Palms in Las Vegas. So
he is not
DC.
Part of my book, Tommy Giacomo.
No, he's not. I'm like, anyways, but or any of the, like, I'm just like, this interpreter is the guys from Gold's Gym. Like, he is just a pawn in the whole big thing. But I'm curious what your read on the situation is.
So let's get the key statement out of the way off the top. Shohei has denied any involvement. Yes. He has denied ever gambling. He's denied knowledge of gambling.
You're such a good journalist. I'm like, just tell me what you think. Yeah.
This is
all us saying our speculation based off his denials. We don't know. No one knows. Okay, now go.
Let me tell you what I can say based on what I know about how it went down with Pete Rose. And what I know about gamblers in general. Gamblers, especially someone who's gambling a lot, they have to talk about it. You know, it is not something that no one knows about. A gambler who's betting a lot is talking to his close pals about the action he's got going that day. A gambler who's betting a lot will have mood swings based on how the outcomes of those games have gone. So again, if it was Ippe Mizuhara, the former interpreter, and Shohei Ohtani's closest friend in Los Angeles who was placing these bets on a regular basis, I find it highly unlikely, just as someone who knows a little something about gambling, that no one would know, that his close friends wouldn't know. I find that unlikely based on what I know about gamblers. And I think, based on what we know about Pete Rose, we are probably going to learn a lot more about what really happened here. You know, Pete and Shohei are different because, you know, it was Pete who was alleged to have gambled, and it was Pete who was alleged to have gambled on baseball, which breaks the cardinal rule of baseball and threatens the integrity of the game for all the reasons we know. That's different right now with Shohei Ohtani. What is similar is that early on, both men have denied any involvement whatsoever. And it was investigators who began to get to the truth. You know, when Pete Rose's scandal first breaks, not long before opening day, 35 years ago, it's a rumor and it's murky and no one really knows. And it's easy for Pete to say they're wrong because nobody really knows.
Right.
But by the end of May, Major League Baseball has a dossier of thousands of pages of documents that includes depositions, legal depositions, with one man who has placed Pete's bets on baseball. It includes a deposition with the bookie who has taken the bets. And it includes gambling records, which in 1989 were notes and notepads and notebooks. But today are very likely to be texts and IP addresses and other such things. So I think in a matter of weeks or months, we're going to know a lot more. And we may get to the closer version of the truth. That truth may be ugly. And the biggest concern I would have if I was Shohei Ohtani's team or Ippei Mizuhara's team is that this alleged illegal bookie in question begins to talk. Because if he does, we're going to know things that nobody knows at this hour, and the scandal could implode from there.
Ugh, an implosion for the Dodgers. What a dream. I only hope that this can come true for all of us Giants fans and all of us Dodger haters across this great nation. I have a question about the audiobook, because I did listen to this on audio, and the audiobook narrator was fantastic, Ellen Adair. But I do have a question, because she is a woman, and I was really curious about that choice. I had my own hypothesis about why you all went with her, but I'm curious if you can speak to that at all.
So I did not know Ellen personally when the project began, but last year I came to connect with her through social media. She is a massive baseball fan, a Phillies fan. We'll forgive her for that.
Oh, what a nightmare.
Exactly. She's a huge baseball fan, really passionate about baseball. And she was also the voice for one of Joe Posnanski's books, the famed baseball writer Joe Posnanski. And so I wanted someone who read this book to be someone who was passionate about baseball. And I loved her work on Posnanski's book. I love, you know, the love she spreads for baseball online. And you know, when we were canvassing for our audiobook narrator, we did listen to a number of samples. And there was an early inclination from some folks that we should go with a man, just like a knee-jerk reaction that sort of happens. But I listened to Ellen's read. I loved it. And to me, it doesn't matter whether it's a man or a woman reading the book. If the voice is strong, if it conveys the emotion, and it was important for me that the person actually care about the story, and Ellen absolutely did, and so that's why I went with her.
I love that. She was great. She was so great. My hypothesis was actually that if a man had read the book, you wouldn't be able to relate to Pete Rose at all, because some of the things that he did and said were so just horrible that hearing it out of a man's voice would be such a turnoff. Like, I kept thinking about, especially like the extramarital affairs and like about his wives and stuff. I just was like, I don't know if some dude was like being like, the girl was 14. I would have been like, you know what? It feels a little flip, even though like it's just because that's the story. So I was like, oh, maybe they picked her because she also like could kind of like soften him a little bit for the listener. But I just think maybe that's just what I got from it.
Yeah. It wasn't that. And I just do remember I was already thinking about Ellen before any recommendations came from the publisher. But when the original email did come, they had five samples. And the first four were men, all great, great reads. Yeah. Incredible talents. And then the fifth one was sort of a curveball here, no pun intended. What about Ellen Adair? And I said, oh my gosh, I have been thinking about Ellen. We follow each other on social media. Yes, let's get a sample from Ellen. Let's see what she thinks about this read.
I love that. She did such a great job. So for folks who are not sure, the audiobook I highly recommend too. So don't worry if you're some people, you know, they are, like to know for sure if the audiobook's good, and she's great. Okay, let's talk about your process. I know we like so much baseball. I feel like I got to talk about writing too. How do you like to write? How often? How many hours a day? Music or no? TV, snacks, beverages, etc.
By the way, I'm going to title my memoir Snacks and Beverages just based upon your question at the end of every podcast. Or maybe you should. That
maybe
should be
I
your
should.
Memoir.
Yes.
That should be your memoir. So, you know, as a nonfiction writer, I have to do the reporting. I have to do the research. And when I'm in research mode, you know, whether I'm doing hours and hours of interviews a day, or I'm in the federal court archive, or I'm in a real archive, that's the mode I'm in. And I'm not doing any writing during that time.
Okay.
But of course, I'm thinking about it. And I'm always thinking about it. And I'm identifying in the moment in the archive, oh my gosh, this deposition is so crucial to this part of the narrative. Once I, you know, believe I have enough to get started, I start to write. And when I'm writing, I love to just be at it first thing in the morning. So I have two kids. The kids get out the door to school. I walk the dogs. And I'm, you know, ideally at my desk writing before 9 o'clock. Okay. And I just try to get in the zone. And unlike you, I'm not a tea guy. I'm a coffee guy.
Coffee guy.
Black coffee. Too much of it, probably. and I will, you know, write for as long as I can in that work day. And I try to get every day to a good stopping point. I find it a challenge as a writer to wake up the next day and dive into a messy part of the draft. Okay. So I want to get to a nice clean break, whether that's sort of a section break or just sort of a thematic break, so that I feel like I have some sort of closure there. Mm-hmm. And then when I come back to the desk the next morning, after getting the kids out the door and walking the dogs and having my coffee, I will reread what I wrote the day before. Mm-hmm. I will make quick tweaks to that. I will not belabor it. Mm-hmm. If you linger too long on what you wrote the day before, you'll never get started again. Mm-hmm. But I'll read that 800 words or 600 words or 1,200 words or whatever it is. And then I just keep going again. And write as long as I can. And if I have to come back late in the day at night, just to get to that clean break, that's what I do.
I love that. How does this book compare for you to your other books? Do you have favorites of your own work? Do you have like those kind of feelings? I know this is your newest child, so you might love it a little bit more, but I'm just curious, or maybe less because it's not sleeping at night and keeping you up and all of those things. But I'm just curious, like, how do you think about this in relationship to the other books that you've written?
You know, every book I've written is important to me. I love them all. It's the cliche. They're your children. You love all your children. But your children have different skills and talents and special parts of them, right? I mean, they do.
And you love some more than others, let's be honest. I'm a parent. I have twins. I fucking know. One of my kids gets on my last nerve.
You are so funny.
I won't say which one.
I love it. You know, so I will say about this book, what's different about it is it is more personal because I sort of lived it, because it was that this narrative, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose, is sort of the backdrop of my childhood, because in a great many ways, that whole story and all the problems that Pete has created still looms over Cincinnati, my hometown. So for all those reasons, it is definitely my most personal book, even though I'm not in it. You know, right. You know, there's no first person in this story at all, but it is more personal. And there were times in writing it, you know, whether it was writing about Pete's collapse in 1989 and remembering what that felt like as a teenaged boy in 1989, or, you know, writing about a neighborhood on the west side of Cincinnati that I know, that it was just distinctly more personal. And another thing happened along the way. You know, I was interviewing these folks, the people who lived it, not just Pete Rose, but say John Dowd, you know, the investigator who pursues Pete Rose, who was hired by Bart Giamatti. And in Cincinnati in the 1980s, and in some cases still today, you know, John Dowd is a villain. And people still say, not just in Cincinnati, but baseball fans everywhere sometimes still say, you know, Bart Giamatti and John Dowd, they had a vendetta against Pete Rose. And those are things that I might have thought once, you know, say in 1989 as a fan, as a teenager. But in interviewing the people around Bart Giamatti, in interviewing John Dowd at length many times, you know, I learned so much about how this moment affected him and how this was in many ways the defining moment of his life, for good or for ill. And that John Dowd is still carrying all of these feelings about Pete Rose on his shoulders 35 years later. And one thing that was just stunning again and again was how emotional sources got when talking to me about Pete. It was as if they had briefly passed through his universe. And that time there had shaped them forever. And in talking about it, they would become emotional. And that is something that's happened to me many times, of course, as a journalist over the years, but never in a book, you know, like this, you know. It was emotional.
That's so interesting. Okay, we're almost out of time, but I have three quick questions. One is, what's the word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
I cannot spell rhythm. No idea.
I have to tell you, Keith, your name is impossible for me. Because one is E-I and one is I-E, and I get it wrong. Keith is already a hard name for me. O'Brien is just, it's so disrespectful that your name is the I-E-E-I, like, complex actively happening. Every time I go to, like, write about this book and write your name, I get it wrong. And so you are now my, like, nightmare of a guest because of your name. It's so hard for me.
Tracy, you can spell my name however you want.
Well, you'll probably find typos when we post about this episode. For people who love Charlie Hustle, what are some other books you might recommend that are in conversation with what you've created?
Well, I mean, there are some great baseball narratives out there that I think, you know, share certain qualities. I'm a huge fan of David Halberstam. And my favorite book, baseball book that he did was October 1964, although there are many. And you know, if you're looking to capture the grittiness of baseball, I think Jonathan Mailer's Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, about the 1977 Yankees and Reggie Jackson, that is another one of my favorite baseball books.
Okay. That was the one that came to my mind too. Okay. Last question. If you could have one person dead or alive read this book, who would you want it to be?
Oh my gosh. You know, to me, broadcasters and radio and television broadcasters of baseball sort of become like the voice in your head for baseball. And for me, because of my age and because of my era, that voice is Bob Costas. And if Bob Costas could read my book and find anything in it enjoyable, it would be amazing.
Did y'all send it to him?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, good. Okay, good. All right, folks, this has been just a joy of a conversation with Keith O'Brien. Good luck spelling that, folks. The book is called Charlie Hustle. It is out in the world. You can get it wherever you get the book. Audio is fantastic. Page is fantastic. I loved, loved, loved this book. And for those of you listening who are like, I don't like sports and I don't like baseball, I would say you can definitely read this book because Pete Rose is such a character and the scandal is just such a scandal and he's such like a scammer bad guy that it is just, again, that anti-hero narrative. When I went into the book, I thought this is only a book for baseball people. And when I got about halfway through, I was like, oh no, I think regular people who don't like to have fun and don't like baseball, they could enjoy it too. So if you're on the fence, I think you'd like it. But all that to say, Keith, thank you so much for being here.
It was my pleasure, Tracy. So much fun.
And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. All right, y'all, that does it for us today. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you again to Keith O'Brien for being my guest. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to Michiko Clark for helping to make this conversation possible. Remember, next week is the Stacks Book Club conversation of The January Children by Safia El-Hilo. We will be discussing that book with Hala Alyan on Wednesday, April 24th. If you love the show and you want inside access to it, head over to patreon.com/thestacks to join the Stacks Pack or go to tracythomas.substack.com to read Unstacked. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave us a rating and a review. For more From the Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And you can check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. This episode of The Stacks was edited by Christian Duenas with production assistance from Lauren Tyree. Our graphic designer is Robin McCright, and our theme music is from Tegirigis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.